So tonight we're going to look at the last of the dhammas, the things that we can contemplate that the Buddha laid out in the fourth foundation of mindfulness. And that's the Four Noble Truths. And I have to tell you that when I first started looking and studying this sutta, oh, 10 years ago now, I couldn't quite figure out what these thing why this was the last thing, because it seems to me that somehow or other the Four Noble Truths are the very first thing the Buddha taught. They're the beginning, but they're both, what's interesting, and it's becoming clearer to me, not perfectly clear but clearer, that the Four Noble Truths are both the beginning of the Buddha's teachings and the end, and that they're that the teaching in essence comes full circle. A long time ago, I wrote an article, and and that's been to me quite surprisingly often quoted, where I said that the teachings aren't a straight line; they're like a spiral. You start someplace wherever you are, and you get a little knowledge and you get some practice, and then you come around and then you go through everything again, but now you go a little bit deeper. You've seen something, and so that's what I think is going on here, where we've come full circle back to the Four Noble Truths. And I just find that, I thought I'd mention that because I find it kind of fascinating. So this is, but this is, remember, now we're not looking at the Four Noble Truths as some sort of interesting philosophical discussion, but as a living thing that we need to really grok, that we really need to tune into. And this is what in some sense, is the shortest of all the dhammas in terms of the actual text in the sutta. He knows as it really is, this is dukkha. He knows as it really is, this is the arising of dukkha. He knows as it really is, this is the cessation of dukkha. He knows as it really is, this is the way leading to the cessation of dukkha. That's it. I mean, the wording is quite simple. So the question here is, what does it mean when the Buddha says to know as it really is? Because it repeats that four times, right? He knows as it really is, this is dukkha. He knows as it really is, this is the arising of dukkha. So he's like hammering away on the fact that we have to have insight into the Four Noble Truths as opposed to knowledge of them. We have to start with the knowledge. That's how the mind works in a way. And that's also our Western mind works very well that way. So we have to, be able to, like, at least be able to, recite the Four Noble Truths. What are they? And then we start to understand more, study them more, go into them more deeply. But at a certain point, what the Buddha is pointing out here is that in our experience, in our meditative experience, we come to a point where we clearly see, not through knowledge, but through practice, through insight, we understand the Four Noble Truths. We see them as it really is. So how do we do that? It's remember that the First Noble Truth basically is, sarvam dukkham. There is suffering, there is unsatisfactoriness, there is, things don't work the way we want them to. Things aren't working out, and we can't quite figure out why. And one thing that my teacher Guy Armstrong told me once, and actually emphasized quite strongly, is a teaching called the five remembrances. And these are things that you can contemplate. And he suggested every day. He even suggested if you wanted to, before you actually sat, you would just read the five remembrances. Remind yourself of the five remembrances. Now, no need to write these down. If you Google five remembrances, you'll find 37 different articles about them and lots of translations that are slightly different versions of this. So unless you can't resist and then you really want to write them down, go ahead. But it's very easy to find these things online. I went Googled just to see what was there, and it was like astonishing how much was there just at first blush. But here are the five remembrances. So these are the five things that we should really remember every day. I'm sure to become old. I cannot avoid aging. I'm sure to become ill. I cannot avoid illness. I'm sure to die. I cannot avoid death. I must be separated and parted from all that is dear and beloved to me. And finally, I'm the owner of my actions, heir of my actions. Actions are the womb from which I have sprung. Actions are my relations. Actions are my protection. Whatever actions I do, good or bad, of these I shall become the heir. So this is like, at first glance, pretty grim stuff. We remind ourselves every day that we're getting old, we're going to get ill one day, we're going to die one day. Everything that we hold dear, we're going to lose. And that this is all up to us, this business of we own our own actions. This is the statement of the laws of karma. But it's really clear to me that all of these things are true, number one. Without doubt, I mean, none of us can deny the fact that we're all going to get old, we're all going to get sick, we're all going to die. And everything we have, we're going to lose. I used to do, I spent a lot of time doing hospice work. And the one thing that struck me over and over and over again as I sat talking with people who were approaching the end of life. In some cases, people were in hospice 3 or 4 months before they actually passed. So they were still somewhat mobile often and could talk and were quite happy to sit and chat. And the thing I heard over and over and over and over and over is, I used to be able to go for a long walk. I used to be able to taste my food. And that was their reality, was that they were becoming separated and parted from all the things they loved. That was what their experience was. It was like a predominant theme in my discussions with them and chats with them. Even if we weren't talking like, oh, you know, you're dying, this is really sick, it would just sort of come up. Like we'd be talking about, you know, he'd ask, you know, he or she would ask me, oh, what did you do on the weekend? Oh, I went for a hike. And, oh, I used to be able to go for hikes. And, you know, it was like, it was just this theme. And so what these all point to and why I think they're a good way to actually start to know dukkha as it really is that all of these five remembrances point to the impermanence of everything, including this. This is just as impermanent as everything else. Nothing stays the same. Nothing lasts. And we somehow or other think that somehow or other we're Oh, that's true for everyone else, but not for me. I'm the exception to that rule, right? I'm sorry. I'm not gonna have to deal with any of that stuff, that messy stuff that everybody else has to deal with. But we are. And having the other thing about this is that it reminds us, and I've talked about this a little bit before, how limited our time is, and that we should really make use of this valuable time we have right now, where we're all together enough that we can sit here and listen and talk and practice. It's not guaranteed you'll be able to do that tomorrow. Who knows? You never know. So he's like, don't waste any time, is really what these things are saying as well. But how does this, how do we get to this point where we have a, what I'll call a true acceptance of impermanence? And I can only tell you what a personal experience I had. This is on one of my long retreats. This is, oh, it's a 6-week retreat. I'm 4 weeks in, so I'm quite settled and quite concentrated. And to be honest with you, somewhat happy-go-lucky because I'm having a great time. And then I started having these experiences. I can't call them anything else. I don't know another word for them. They weren't like visions or something like that. They were, I would actually experience as I was sitting in meditation, I would experience my own death. Or I'd experience the death of my wife. Both of these were incredibly unpleasant. And because, I mean, it was either, I'd be like, oh, I'm okay, I'm dying, but I'm okay, we all die. You know, I was being very sort of cool about it. But of course, my wife, my partner, would be very upset. And then I would be upset because she was upset. That would be what I'd actually be experiencing. So there I was actually experiencing, in a sense, and this is when I say experience, I mean over and over again. I mean, this happened like a dozen times in a period of like 4 or 5 days. This over and over and over again, I'd have these experiences. The truth of this, my situation, I mean, here's this person who's more important to me than anyone else, 41 years together. At that point, maybe it was only like 35 years together, but whatever, a long time together. And it's inevitable that one of us is going to die, and that's going to be difficult. This going to means I'm that what person's going to suffer. Don't see too many people who die who don't suffer first. Sometimes very quickly, sometimes not so quickly. And that the other person, the partner, is also going to suffer. So here's this most beautiful, incredible thing in my life, and built right in, is suffering. Guaranteed suffering. Without a doubt, suffering. Ah. And that's what this was all about. I was like, hey, pay attention. This is where you think you're exempt. No, I'm sorry, you're not. And I want to be very careful here. I'm not in any sense suggesting that sarvam dukkham, all is suffering, how it's sometimes translated, means we should just avoid having any relationships with anybody. We should just, unless we're the rare person who's a true monastic hermit kind of person, we can't avoid having relationships with others. We have children, we have parents, we have brothers and sisters, and there's all that relational stuff, and there's all those strong, wonderful things that we experience in our relationships with others, friends. We can't avoid that. We can't avoid that for 1 second. It's futile to try. So we just have to understand that built right into all of that is the inevitability of these five remembrances. It's going to come. And it doesn't for 1 second, that understanding, that knowledge, that intuition, doesn't for 1 second negate the beauty and joy of those same relationships. That's the mystery to me somehow, that it's both beautiful, wonderful, incredible having these people in my life and knowing that it's all going to go like that. Who knows when? And being able to sort of live with those two things balanced somehow. So that's what I want to say about know as it really is. You know, this is dukkha. Dukkha is like just embedded in everything without exception, because everything's impermanent. Everything is changing all the time. That's just the law of nature. So then we get to the second noble truth, the source, the cause of dukkha, the suffering. What's the cause? Why is it that all those things have built into them this unsatisfactoriness? And basically, to understand as it really is, this is the source of suffering, we have to understand clinging, which is what the Second Noble Truth says, basically. We suffer, we find everything unsatisfactory because we cling. We want to hold tightly to the pleasant. I don't want to die. I don't want my partner to die. I don't want my kids to die. I don't want any of those people to get sick. So I cling to this idea that somehow or other the people I care about are exempt. No, what happened to them? That's how we keep fooling ourselves into thinking that. We don't see that clinging to that idea is what causes the suffering. If we fully accept the fact that, yes, this is the way things are, that these five remembrances state things as they really are, without a doubt. Excuse me while I blow my nose here. Hope that wasn't too loud in your headphones. And it's not that these things, these people, these objects, these whatever, cause the problem. It's our clinging to them, our deep attachments to them, are not wanting them to change, but wanting them to be permanent. That's the source of the actual suffering. That's where it comes from. And we cling to, in a lot of ways. I mean, I at one point a while back, I gave a talk just about clinging. I remember 6-7 months ago, maybe at this point. But it's like, there are four main categories of things that we actually cling to tenaciously sometimes. We cling to things, things in the broadest sense. So not just like my car and my house, but my partner, my cat, my dog, blah, 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 blah. You know, all those things, you know, my tools in my case, I cling to my tools for sure. And so that's level one. But then on a deeper level, we cling to ideas, concepts, beliefs, views. We think this is the way things are. And if why doesn't everybody else understand? Like I, wise me, and I understand. Why don't everybody else understand that how true this is? We cling to these views that we have of how things are right and how things are wrong and who's right and who's wrong. And they're just ideas in the mind. But we're convinced that we're right. And then things change. And we go, oh, it's not the way I thought it was at all. But we've clung to that view. And those views might be from things we've read. It might be how we grew up. You know, I grew up in a world where I grew up in a very blue-collar family. And so my view on many things, and I have to watch for this all the time, is that blue-collar view of, you know, the honest, you know, it's good to work, and what's wrong with these lazy people who don't work all the time, and blah, 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 blah. And, you know, it's all about keeping things simple because we don't have a lot, but we do okay even though we don't have a lot. You know, family stories about going on vacation and coming home from vacation and all of us shaking out our pockets to get enough change to buy gas to get the rest of the way home. I mean, it's like these myths we have about ourselves. But we think that's good. That's the right way. I know the right way. I know how I think people should be. And when people aren't like that, then we get upset. We get angry. We attack them. Suffering, suffering, suffering all the way along. So we cling just to this idea that this is the right way. I know. Then there's, on a subtler level, there are what the Buddha called religious practices and beliefs. You know, we believe that we know how things really are on the sort of grander level. God exists, God doesn't exist, God's male, God's female, and so on and so on and so on and so on. Take your pick of some beliefs. And we cling to those. And if you look at the world and how much of the world and how much of the wars and fighting that goes on in the world is based on people clinging to those beliefs. So take away that clinging and there's almost no more war left, right? that's just there. And then, and the most difficult one, things we cling to a sense of a separate self. We cling to this idea that there's me, not me. That somehow or other, I am separate and in control, even more complicated, even more dangerous, of my separateness. And if I feel that separateness is attacked, boy, do I ever suffer. Usually by reacting in unwholesome ways to the person or the institution or whatever that's doing the attacking, or at least in my perception is doing the attacking. Often it's just differences of opinion. But we build up this sense of a separate self all day long, every day. And then we cling to it because it's like, well, that's who I am. What if I get rid of all those things that create my identity? What's left? Scary, scary question. But it's something we all have to deal with at some point. We have to stop that clinging. Interestingly, when the Buddha talked about his enlightenment, he said the very last thing he had to deal with was his clinging to a subtle sense of self. So don't worry if it's like, oh, well, this is the tough one. But we can, even in little ways, we start to see it. It's very skillful and helpful when we start to see. So to know as it really is, what we have to do is constantly questioning, how am I clinging in this situation? What am I clinging to? Am I clinging? Typically the answer is pretty much always going to be yes, by the way, to some level of this. And then we start to see, you know, in our practice, how we start clinging to our practice. And this is another thing to cling to, by the way. Even that has, we can't even cling to that. So this is, in a sense, how we can know as it really is, by seeing very clearly the clinging arise, actually consciously noting. Clinging is a very useful, skillful note to make when you're practicing. It's because you're seeing underneath the story, the presentation that's going on in the mind, and you start to see the root, the clinging root of it, and you go, clinging. Or, you know, clinging to ideas. Or clinging to my sense of self. Or just clinging to my car because I like my car. we cling to everything, right? So that's what this, to the know as it actually is, this is the cause of dukkha, is to clearly see over and over and over again how we cling. So then there's the third noble truth, which is, and this is, you know, the sea as it really is, this is the what is the actual words here? This is the cessation of dukkha. To see very clearly that when we stop clinging to something, when we let it go, you know, often this practice is talked about as a practice of letting go. And what we're letting go to is the things we cling to. And just when you do that, and it may be like as you're sitting there practicing, or it might be in your daily life, when you let go of that clinging, it's like, it's such a sweet time. And we have to see that. We have to see, to really understand it, it really is this third noble truth. We have to see how, when we stop clinging, how happy we are. How just stopping clinging brings joy. The thing that we were clinging to because we thought it was going to make us happy. Interesting paradox, right? We've been clinging to this thing because we thought it was going to make us happy. By just letting go of that thing, happiness just arises naturally. Joy arises naturally. And we have to see and acknowledge and note that joy. this is a theme I've been coming back to a lot over the last 3-4 weeks. But it's that those moments when we're calm, when we're still, when we're focused, when we're concentrated, when mindfulness is clearly there, it's because we're not clinging. And we have to actually be able to see that, that there's, at that moment or in those moments or in that period of time, we're not clinging to anything. That's when we start to see the cessation of dukkha. That this is what it is. And it's that, I mean, the sweetness, the pleasantness of these mind states when they arise are really encouraging, number one. But also it's like, oh, look, I should actually enjoy this. You know, we need to be able to enjoy the practice. We need to find joy in the practice. We need to find happiness in the practice. I mean, the Buddha was called the Happy One. That was one of his nicknames, right? I mean, often people say, oh, you've been hanging out with the Happy One, huh? It's like, that's who he was, that he was the Happy One. And we need to acknowledge that and enjoy that and let that really sink in. However, at a certain point, this sensation, in a sense, this intuitive state of not clinging, leaves us with just this meditative knowledge, this meditative moment or moments of pure knowing, where all that's happening is we're knowing. With a capital K, perhaps, knowing. Like it's not in an intellectual sense. But we see, like, we're not caught by anything. We're not clinging to anything. There's just this pure knowing and our clear insight that that's all that's there. Like we can know that we're knowing. And nothing else. But, there's always a but, right? This is, I want to read what Joseph Goldstein has to say about this. Because I think this was, I found this really interesting when I was prepping for this talk. So, in the meditative process, sometimes all objects seem to disappear and all that's left is consciousness. The knowing mind. So we're in this state where, like, there's no body anymore. You don't have any bodily sensation at all. There's just nothing happening except the actual pure knowing. But care is needed here because there can be a subtle attachment to this state, an identification with awareness itself. This becomes an interesting place of investigation. We can notice how easy it is to make a home of awareness and have a sense of self settle right in. I'm the one who knows. This is a subtle sense of self that I mentioned earlier. This is what the Buddha, the last thing he had to deal with. It's this subtle sense of being just, I am. It's not just that knowing is happening. It's that I am knowing different things. Consciousness is not a thing that exists, but an event that occurs. So it's not even this knowing, this mind isn't a thing. It's just a process. The question then arises, how can we cut through this subtle identification with knowing with consciousness? Different traditions use different methods. As mentioned earlier, Mahasi Sayadaw describes this state very clearly and reminds meditators to keep noting the knowing mind until one goes beyond even knowing. So at some point, this knowing ceases, or so I'm told. I can only just read it from the book, I'm sorry. In some Tibetan and Zen traditions, another approach is to cut through any identification with knowing, looking for the mind itself. Tulku Ungyen Rinpoche would often instruct his students to look for the mind. Can you see it, taste it, touch it? When you look for it, there's nothing to find. The mind, have you ever found your mind? It's just sort of, we have an assumption that we have one. I have a mind. Oh, there's a lot of identification going on there. When you look for it, there's nothing to find. And the not finding is the finding. Another paradoxical statement. When we recognize that moment of not finding, the mind empties and selfless nature is revealed. Okay, so that's to know as it really is, the third noble truth. And then to know the fourth noble truth, the practice, the way, the path. The only way I can see that we can actually know as it really is to actually just practice the path. And that's really all it comes down to. It's like to actually consciously choose and then with full intention and full integrity, practice. That's how we get to know as it really is, the fourth noble truth. I mean, we can all, you know, hopefully eventually, it took me a while, we can quote the eight steps on the Eightfold Path and, you know, sound very knowledgeable and wise. That's just book knowledge. We actually have to know it by experiencing it through practice. We have to consciously choose the practice. So the Buddha said over and over and over again. He said, you know, don't believe me. He literally said, there's some places in the sutta where he actually says this. He says, don't believe a word I said. Just practice and find out for yourself. Don't believe me. Just practice. Another section I want to read here from Joseph. He's talking about the Eightfold Path. There. It is not insignificant that the Buddha calls this last of the noble truths a path. The implication is that these eight successive steps lead somewhere, that there is a final goal. Although the notion of goal can sometimes lead to overstriving, to a kind of spiritual ambition that gets in the way of realization, this overstriving has more to do with how we are practicing rather than the understanding that there is indeed an end of dukkha. René Dumal, in his book, Mount Analog, describes the crucial balance between living fully in the moment and at the same time keeping the vision of our final destination. Keep your eye fixed on the way to the top, but don't forget to look right in front of you. The last step depends on the first. Don't think you've arrived just because you see the summit. Watch your footing. Be sure of the next step, but don't let that distract you from the highest goal. The first step depends on the last. Isn't that great? The last step depends on the first, but the first step depends on the last. And that's how we have to walk this path. There's no other way. And that's how we can know as it really is the path to realization. By just practicing it, consciously choosing over and over and over. Every day when we wake up, we say, oh, I gotta practice. Make this day another day of practice. That's the only way. So that's what I have to say about this. This seems, my concern with this seems sort of maybe a little bit esoteric, but also like, well, that's not for me. You know, that's for those advanced people. Which is honestly how I felt for a long time. Oh yeah, that's great. I'll think about that later. But this is something that every time we form the intention to practice, we have to have this in our mind. This is why we're practicing. This really see this as it is. To see things as they really are. And that's the definition of mindfulness, right? To see things as they really are. You see that all the time. Well, that's what the Buddha is talking about in this last section of the sutta. To see his teachings, his central teaching, the teaching he gave the very first time he taught and then taught in many, many ways for the rest of his life, for 40 odd years. And really, all the rest of his teachings are just different expressions of the Four Noble Truths, different ways of looking at it, different ways of speaking about it, different angles of approach to explain it. But really, it all just comes down to the Four Noble Truths. So that's why it's both the beginning and the end. Okay, so let's just practice and be mindful of the Four Noble Truths. And if you're listening to this as a recording, at this point you should probably pause the recording, do your sitting practice, and then turn the recording back on for some concluding remarks and things. So this concludes our 8 weeks of looking at the Satipatthana Sutta. I just want to mention that the book Mindfulness I've been reading from Joseph Goldstein is based on a series of 47 talks he gave on the Satipatthana Sutta. So I let you off really easy, only 8. But that certainly, that book, Mindfulness by Joseph Goldstein, has been the source of a lot of what I've been able to say. I've studied it and gone back through it at times and read several passages to tonight, for instance. So if you want to go deeper into these ideas, that would be, I'd highly recommend that book. So we have, as usual, a few minutes for questions, comments, thoughts. Anything you'd like to share, that's fine. And as usual, if you don't feel the need or the desire to speak at this point, that's also perfectly fine. Don't feel at all obliged to participate in any way. Just wave and let me know you want to speak. Maybe Lisa's cat has something wise to say. Sure, Deborah, go ahead.
I just wanted to say thank you for teaching this course. It's been very good. I'm still absorbing.
Yeah, well, so am I. That's the beauty of these teachings, is there's always more. You just go deeper and deeper, and then you make little discoveries along the way, even just preparing the course. I mean, part of the reason I love to teach is that I learn. That I actually, oh, look, I never thought of it quite that way. Oh, gee, I forgot that this part. And, you know, it sort of keeps me on my toes, which is always good. So, that, but thank you, Deborah. Okay. So it sounds like we're nearing the end. Which, you know, for me means I can't end without a poem. This is from Mary Oliver's Why I Wake Early. And it, in a sense, it speaks to knowing things as they really are. It's called Snow Geese. Oh, to love what is lovely and will not last. What a task to ask of anything or anyone, yet it is ours, and not by the century or the year, but by the hours. One fall day I heard above me and above the sting of the wind a sound I did not know, and my look shot upwards. It was a flock of snow geese winging it faster than the ones we usually see, and being the color of snow, catching the sun, so they were, in part at least, golden. I held my breath, as we do sometimes, to stop time, when something wonderful has touched us, as with a match which is lit and bright but does not hurt in the common way, but delightfully, as if the light were the most serious thing you ever felt. The geese flew on. I've never seen them again. Maybe I will someday, somewhere. Maybe I won't. It doesn't matter. What matters is that when I saw them, I saw them as through the veil, secretly, joyfully, clearly. What more could you ask? It's a moment of pure mindfulness, is what she's describing here. Let's dedicate the merit. May the beneficial energies arising from our practice here together today become the causes and conditions for the end of suffering and the awakening of all beings everywhere. Thank you all for joining me.